From O'Melveny & Myers, this is Achieve With.
Welcome to Achieve With, the O'Melveny podcast featuring this country's leading lawyers talking about the biggest issues in technology, the economy, and of course, the law. I'm Rebecca Mermelstein. The war in the Ukraine, Russian hackers, crypto exchanges, all hot button topics, and all the subject of our topic today, trends in national security enforcement. I couldn't be more delighted to be joined by three women who are truly experts in this field. My partner, Annalou Tirole, who before joining O'Melveny was the deputy director of FinCEN, and before that, a federal prosecutor for 15 years. And our guests, Nagar Tekye and Tara Lamort, both prosecutors in the preeminent Southern District of New York, my old stomping grounds, and chiefs of the National Security and International Narcotics Unit and the Illicit Finance and Money Laundering Unit. Welcome, Nagar and Tara.
It is so great to have you both. Before we jump in, I should preface for our listeners that our guests are speaking to us in their personal capacities and not on behalf of the government. So, Nagar and Tara, for those who don't know exactly what you do, can I ask you to explain what you do as a unit chief at the U.S. Attorney's Office? Nagar, let's start with you.
First, thank you so much, Rebecca and Annalou, for inviting us. We are happy to be here discussing the important work we do at SDNY and throughout the department. The National Security and International Narcotics Unit is responsible for the investigation and prosecution of domestic and international criminal conduct that threatens U.S. national security, including counterterrorism, counterintelligence, sanctions evasion, export control, malign foreign influence, transnational repression, and international narcotics and weapons trafficking matters.
That is a really great background. Thank you for that, Nagar. And how about you, Tara?
So, yes, thank you for having me as well. I'm excited to join this conversation with you. So as chief of the Illicit Finance and Money Laundering Unit, I too supervise a group of AUSAs who are responsible for bringing cases that I say would fall within, largely speaking, one of three buckets. One of them is Bank Secrecy Act enforcement. And so we will enforce the Bank Secrecy Act against all manner of financial institutions. And that includes their AML programs, their KYC programs, and determine whether there are willful violations of that statute. We also have a robust sanctions practice, and we have been very active in enforcing the speed of Russian sanctions that has been implemented in the aftermath of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And we're also very active in terms of the forfeiture space as well, which has been an important complement to that. And then sort of our last bucket is large-scale international money laundering networks.
I was going to ask a very more basic question for people who aren't as familiar with this sphere, which is we're throwing away around lots of acronyms, lots of terminology. But when you talk about export controls and sanctions, what is the basic framework of what you're talking about? What are the things that are a problem?
Happy to talk about that. The types of sanctions we're talking about today are laws that impose financial and trade restrictions against individuals, entities, particular jurisdictions that violate U.S. foreign policy or national security goals. And these sanctions are administered primarily by the Department of Treasury's Office of Foreign Assets Control. That's OFAC. And some immediate examples that come to mind include sanctions and sanctions enforcement surrounding task force klepto capture, which Tara's unit works a lot with and our unit works a lot with as well. So sanctions imposed in response to Russia's military invasion of Ukraine and the way that those sanctions are enforced. Export controls are similarly laws that target the export of particularly sensitive commodities, technologies, and services. And why do we do that? There are particular commodities, technologies, and services that we call dual use technologies, meaning they have commercial uses as well as military uses. And so export controls are designed to make sure that sanctioned countries and designated individuals and entities don't access or acquire U.S. technologies and then try to use them against us or against our allies here and abroad. And so thwarting these unlawful efforts and then holding those who violate our export controls and also our sanctions laws are very much a top priority for the department.
You mentioned KleptoCapture. What is that?
So KleptoCapture is a task force set up in response to Russian aggression that has occurred since 2014. And the goal of KleptoCapture is to dedicate itself to the investigation and prosecution of sanctions and export controls. Those sanctions and export controls that have been imposed in response to Russian aggression since 2014 is probably a better way of saying it. And so there are really sort of two major goals there with the sanctions enforcement. One is to reduce the revenue that Russia has to fight its war against Ukraine. That's one goal. And another goal, and Nagar had alluded to this, is to disrupt Russia's ability to obtain goods and services that it needs to be able to build weapons for defense and military action, right? And so, like, how does the task force operate? The task force, again, is aimed at prosecuting Russian oligarchs against, not just Russian oligarchs, but any person or entity that's sanctioned under the Russia sanctioned regulations. And so one of the goals, again, is to bring charges against sanctioned people, right? Because the idea is that sanctions are not just technical violations. They have national security implications and the like. So we're going to prosecute any person or entity that's sanctioned under the sanctions regulations if they're engaging in sanctions evasion. But frankly, let me just step back a minute. It's not even just sanctions evasion. We will bring any charge against anyone that's designated for any crime that they commit. So you may have a designated person and we may not be able to prove a sanctions evasion charge, but maybe we can prove bank fraud. Maybe we can prove visa fraud, narco trafficking. I mean, the tools are vast and we are not limiting ourselves particularly to sanctions. And so we will pursue any charge or any seizure theory for forfeiture purposes that is available. The task force will support any of those types of charges. The scope, though, goes beyond those persons that are designated under the OFAC regulations, the sanctions regulations. The task force will also pursue investigations and charges against those that facilitate the evasion of economic sanctions or facilitate the committing of crimes by designated persons. So that could be financial institutions that are turning a blind eye or knowingly processing United States dollar financial transactions for designated persons. It could be real estate agents. It could be broker dealers, exporters, manufacturers, even attorneys we have prosecuted in terms of enabling crimes that are being committed by sanctioned individuals. And so I think, again, going back to the theme, this is a whole of government approach. And really, the task force KleptoCapture's mandate is to coordinate the government to ensure that we have a robust sanctions and export controls, investigations and prosecutions and enforcement mechanism.
You both have made very clear how significant and how much of a focus of the work you do this is. DOJ, more generally, has also made very clear that it's making national security a huge priority. I'm thinking, for example, about statements by Marshall Miller last year. He's the principal associate deputy attorney general, in which he announced that the department was going to hire 25 new prosecutors to work on sanctions evasion and export control violations, and would be adding resources to the money laundering and asset recovery sections. And we've all heard Deputy Attorney General Lisa Monaco say that, I'm quoting, sanctions are the new FCPA. And so I want to ask you a little bit about what that means. The Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, as you all know, criminalizes the bribery of foreign officials and has been a big area of enforcement for DOJ. What does it mean for sanctions to be the new FCPA?
So I think when the Deputy Attorney General talks about sanctions being the new FCPA, or others within the department talk about the increased focus of DOJ on corporate enforcement in the national security space, it's about prioritizing enforcement of laws and regulations that have been on the books for decades. Export control laws, sanctions laws that we talked about earlier, holding those who willfully violate these laws accountable while also making compliance a priority in the private sector. And the trend with FCPA enforcement was very similar. Laws that had been on the books for decades, since the 1970s, that became an enforcement priority for the department in the early 2000s. And then you began to see a wave of enforcement measures by prosecutors and regulators that had a major impact on compliance programs, particularly of multinational companies. And today, anti-corruption compliance is a priority for many financial institutions, companies, asset managers, you name it. And so with this wave, this current wave of sanctions and export control enforcement, I think what the department is conveying is and has said that sanctions should be at the forefront of compliance for multinational companies and businesses with international supply chains, because they stand at the front lines of engaging with the world in a way that could help protect our nation's security.
So we've spoken quite a bit about national security enforcement in terms of sanctions and export controls evasions. But it does seem that the government thinks about national security in a much more broad framework, including in areas that people may not realize do have national security implications. So I'm thinking, for example, of the cryptocurrency industry. Is that an area of focus? And can you tell us why?
Sure. It absolutely is an area of focus for our unit. And when we're talking about the cryptocurrency industry, we're talking about sort of primarily actors that control the on and off ramps for converting cryptocurrency to fiat currency, which is your traditional state issue currency, and vice versa. With respect to compliance, if you are a cryptocurrency industry and you serve U.S. users, then we would consider that you are obligated to follow the Bank Secrecy Act, and you're required to have compliance programs, AML programs, anti-money laundering, and know your customer programs in place. And the idea is that we need to protect the integrity of the U.S. financial system, and we need to protect it from inflows of millions, if not billions of dollars of suspicious funds. But when you have cryptocurrency exchanges that operate without such programs and they're availing themselves of the U.S. market, that's a problem. Again, because you're going to have suspicious and criminal funds. It'll be a money laundering haven, in other words, for criminals to be able to move their money worldwide, including within the United States. And so really, when you're talking about large-scale money laundering, that is actually a national security concern. Disguising the flow of funds is what enables, for example, sanctions violation and export control violations to occur. It funds organized crime groups, money laundering, such as narco traffickers. You know, obviously, terrorism financing is a large concern. And if you want to look, for example, at DOJ's prosecution of Binance, and you look at that statement of facts that accompanied Binance's guilty plea, Binance's lack of compliance and lack of AML and KYC is what enabled terrorism financing to go through that platform. So I think, you know, the cryptocurrency sector is playing an increasingly important role in sort of our economic security and internationally and in the world's financial system. And so it's important for us to police this at a systemic level to ensure that we remain protected from all of the crimes and offenses that I just talked about.
And so, Tara, you've mentioned some patterns in terms of risk areas, challenges, and compliance programs. Do you have any thoughts for what companies that are in areas with potentially high risk or high vulnerability to illicit finance, what those companies need to think about?
Sure. I think it's really about ensuring that your AML processes and procedures that are in place are tailored to match the risk of your customer base. And where I have seen, if you want to sort of talk about thematically or holistically, where I have seen issues arise is when you have a company that has a compliance program in place and they take on like a new line of business, right? And that new line of business has a different customer base. You need to be thinking about there, updating your compliance, updating your AML to be commensurate with that risk, because different types of clients are going to pose a different risk to the company and to the financial system. So I think that's one important theme or issue or concern that I have come across is sort of the adding of new business sectors, new types of clientele, new services on companies, and then they don't update their AML or KYC systems to address the new risks or the heightened risks that are imposed by that new business segment or new client base.
And to add on to that, agree completely with what Tara is conveying. You want to be paying close attention to the policy memos and guidance being published by the U.S. government components that regulate these areas. In the last year alone, the Department of Commerce, OFAC, and others have issued a number of policy memos and guidance in conjunction with enforcement efforts to help companies and businesses who are dealing with these issues understand what are the red flags they should be looking for and how should they be modifying and adjusting their internal compliance measures. For example, their customer due diligence, the anti-money laundering controls that Tara's talked about. And these advisories and policy memos list out very specific examples of activities that can expose foreign financial institutions, as one example, to sanctions risk or export control violations. And so you're seeing that in addition to enforcement measures, recommendations being issued regularly about what measures should be implemented. And some of them are the very traditional measures that these institutions are accustomed to putting into place to detect and prevent fraud and money laundering. But it's now transposing those measures toward detecting and protecting against export control violations and sanctions evasions. So it's wrapping their minds around compliance measures that are effective and have been effective in one space and mapping them on to a potentially new area, a burgeoning area of enforcement and regulation.
Can you give us any examples, Nagar? These policies and advisories obviously speak for themselves, but for people who haven't read them before, what are some more traditional, let's say, guidance, and what are some of the newer areas, newer red flags or newer advice for companies that want to do the right thing and that want to be in compliance?
Absolutely. And I would encourage everyone to go to, for example, OFAC's website or the Commerce's website to get more specifics than we'll be able to provide here. But as one example, OFAC's announcement of guidance for foreign financial institutions on sanctions targeting support to Russia's military industrial base, which was issued in December, lists out specific red flag areas, specific mitigation measures that could be taken. I'm looking at it right now, in fact, and they're talking about training on sanctions risks and common red flags, ensuring identified risks or issues are escalated to the proper level, communicating clearly and frequently with U.S. and correspondent banks on their due diligence expectations and requests for information, incorporating information from FinCEN and OFAC alerts and advisories. These are some of the things that you see when financial institutions are concerned about anti-money laundering measures or Bank Secrecy Act violations. And now we're seeing them apply it to export controls and sanctions with direction from the agencies who are responsible for enforcing these laws.
Let me turn to what I think is probably our last topic, given the time. Nagar, you mentioned at the outset that there are various corporate disclosure, corporate cooperation, and in some areas, whistleblower policies that are new. Can you guys lay out for us what are the various policies that exist, the various procedures in those areas, and how is it affecting the work you do?
So last March, the National Security Division issued an enforcement policy for business organizations. It's voluntary self-disclosure guidance, which is very much in line with department-wide guidance on corporate cooperation that would apply in more traditional cases like financial fraud cases or securities fraud enforcement. But again, it applies the self-disclosure guidance to sanctions and export control enforcement. And so the bottom line is that the department is very interested in companies self-reporting and working with, in this case, the National Security Division, to make sure they're complying with sanctions and export control laws, developing incentives for compliance, and of course, penalties for non-compliance, just like you would see in a more traditional fraud case. So the theory being that a company that's a bad actor or a company that fails to implement compliance measures in the national security space can do more harm at a larger scale than an individual bad actor. So that corporations should see compliance with export controls and sanctions as a critical component of their compliance programs. And when they do voluntarily self-disclose or when they do intend to cooperate, cooperation has to be full and complete, the goal always being to mitigate a threat. When a company voluntarily self-discloses potential criminal violations to the National Security Division, fully cooperates, and timely and appropriately remediates certain aggravating factors that are set out in the guidance and consistent with the definitions provided in the guidance, the company will receive particular treatment by the National Security Division and the department.
Tara, what about you? How do the various voluntary self-disclosure whistleblower programs affect the work you're doing?
Right. So I think I could talk a bit about the revamped whistleblower program under the Bank Secrecy Act. The Bank Secrecy Act has long had a whistleblower program, but it was pretty modest, so not nearly as successful as, for example, the SEC's whistleblower program. And so recently, Congress amended the BSA through the AMLA Act, Anti-Money Laundering Act of 2020, to boost up and give some teeth to that whistleblower program. It narrowed the government's discretion to pay an award. It increased the potential amounts of whistleblower rewards, provided specific protections and what have you, and provided that the whistleblower, upon meeting certain conditions, shall be paid an award, whereas before it was discretionary. One thing I can say without getting into specifics is that we have seen more people availing themselves of this whistleblower program than we ever had in the past. And that is obviously invaluable to enforcement efforts. Nothing beats having someone that's in the company or in the network or what have you come tell you sort of what's going on and who knows what and who we should be talking to and, you know, what documents we should be asking for and things along that nature. And so I'm hoping that given the space that I investigate and prosecute and oversee, that the BSA's revamped whistleblower program will continue to, you know, pay dividends and be as successful as the SEC's whistleblower program, because it's an invaluable tool for law enforcement.
Any final thoughts on the direction of national security enforcement?
The bottom line is that corporate criminal enforcement and national security are intersecting in a way that they never have before. We've talked a lot about the department's priorities on sanctions evasion, export control violations. I'd be remiss if I missed talking about FARA, foreign agent registration. These are all activities, these are all enforcement measures, steps being taken relating to hostile nation states and hostile actors who seek to do harm to U.S. nationals and U.S. national interests here and abroad. It's a huge priority to the very top of the department. And I'll also just put in a plug and say that SDNY, with Tara's unit, our unit, and other units in the building, are really at the leading edge of these national security-related corporate and economic criminal enforcement efforts. Can I just add just one more thing?
Please.
I think what everyone is going to see are more investigations in this space. They're going to see more charges, and corporate clients are going to need to conduct some more internal investigations in response to investigative scrutiny. We've talked a lot about how cases in this space often involve cross-border transactions, the use of the U.S. financial system, intermediate shell companies. We will continue to investigate and bring money laundering, wire fraud, bank fraud, and other more traditional economic charges in cases like this, as we have recently. But what the department is conveying and what these agencies are conveying is that U.S. national security is and should be a top priority for the private sector, including financial, technology, telecommunications, and other critical infrastructure spheres. And so we need to prioritize compliance in these areas, and not just to reduce potential legal exposure, but also to mitigate threats to U.S. national security.
I'll just add that I couldn't agree more with NAGAR. I think this area is very active, and I think it's going to continue to be active, including involving the private sector in the entire government's national security approach, right? Like, I think the government is increasingly relying on the private sector to be able to identify, wants the private sector to be in the position to be able to identify threats, right? And to do that, they need robust compliance programs. And I think that is explaining the U.S. government's push for companies, policy statements, and what have you. Here's what you need to put in place. Think of these red flags, because there's a list of like substantive red flags. Are you operating in X jurisdiction? Do you have newly incorporated companies that are doing sort of the same business you were doing with a previous customer? Like, things of that nature. And so it's not only processes, it's also substance. Like, and that goes to the point of training people and ensuring that they are looking out for all of these red flags. And so I sort of think it's an entire nation, U.S. government and private actors working together to ensure that our national security interests, which include our economic interests and the financial integrity of the U.S. financial system, remain protected. And I don't see that. I see that increasing over time. I don't see that decreasing.
Well, I know I speak for Rebecca and others when I say we very much appreciate the time and the insights and the thoughts that you have shared with us. You've both given our listeners a lot to think about and a really great education on what national security enforcement means for the government right now. So thank you so much for your time. This has been wonderful having you both.
Thank you both.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for listening to Achieve With, an O'Melveny & Myers podcast. This podcast is a summary for general information and discussion only and may be considered an advertisement for certain purposes. It is not a full analysis of the matters presented, may not be relied upon as legal advice, and does not create an attorney-client relationship between the firm and the listener. Portions of this communication may contain attorney advertising. Prior results do not guarantee a similar outcome. Views expressed by guests are their own. Please direct all inquiries regarding New York's Rules of Professional Conduct to O'Melveny & Myers, LLP. Times Square Tower, 7 Times Square, New York, New York, 10036. Phone 1-212-326-2000.